Hello and welcome to the Pre-Raphaelite Society podcast, brought to you by the Pre-Raphaelite Society. Today we've got a special guest all the way from Spain. I'm joined by Rogio Miano Rejano. I hope I've got that right. Nearly. And Rogio is here to talk about something that's quite close to the heart of many of our listeners, and that is it's the topic of the character of Ophelia. So, just as a bit of an introduction, Rogio is a PhD student in the doctoral program of linguistics, literature, and translation. She has a BA in English studies from the University of Malaga. She holds an MA in English studies and multilingual intercultural communication from the University of Malaga, as well as another MA in teaching English as a foreign language from Madrid Open University. She's working on a PhD dissertation about the survival and prevalence of the character Ophelia in Pre-Raphaelite paintings and English contemporary literature. In addition, she has contributed to various international journals such as Odissea, Revista de Estudios Ingleses, the Prague Journal of English Studies, and the Journal of Comparative Literature and Aesthetics, among others. Her research interests include critical theory, Pre-Raphaelite painting, inter-art studies, adaptation studies, intermedial studies, and Shakespearean heroines. She is a member of the Pre-Raphaelite Society and the Spanish Association of Anglo-American Studies. Rogio, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Carl. How are you doing?
Oh, very well, thank you. I feel I must apologize for my awful Spanish.
Well, that's no problem because I can correct it and introduce myself and say my name for the English speakers. So, as a way to say it properly. So, my name is Rocío Moyano Rejano. As Carl has said, I'm a PhD student at the University of Malaga, and I'm currently pursuing a dissertation on the character of Ophelia in English contemporary literature and pre-Raphaelite painting. It could be a bit shocking to miss the two arts, but the idea is how the character of Ophelia has been depicted and represented in both mediums, using two terms that are called in critical theory ekphrasis and interfigurality. For those who are not familiar with these terms, interfigurality is when we have a character from a novel or a play. In that case, we have Ophelia in the source material that is Hamlet, and she is placed in another setting or in another novel. It could be a different story, such as a prequel, a sequel, or even a different universe. It could be different. And ekphrasis is the description of a work of art. So we have that some pre-Raphaelite paintings depict Ophelia focusing or basing on the Shakespearean text. So my goal is how to trace or to analyze the different mediums in which Ophelia appears.
Right, and both of those are really quite important to the Pre-Raphaelites as well, aren't they? As well as sort of 21st century English studies. I think they're both ideas that the Pre-Raphaelites played with and used themselves. Could we just talk a little bit about sort of your early work and how you first discovered the Pre-Raphaelites? And it's quite a strange thing to come to, really. How did it happen for you?
Well, to tell the truth, it was a bit accidental and casual because a few years ago, I started following the Twitter account Artista Prerafaelita, who was a topic of your podcast some months ago. And what this account does is to share acquaintance with Prerafaelite painting. People in Spain and around the world. However, it was during my master's degree in English studies when I get or when I got a greater understanding on the prelaphyllites, because for the final assignment of the subject English literature in other arts and disciplines, we were given a list of topics. I decided to write my essay on the relationship between Alfred Lord Tennyson's poem The Lady of Shalott and the subsequent process of reverse ephrasis, that is my some of the terms and I analyzing in the thesis, how this poem has a visual representation in Waterhouse paintings, The Lady of Shalott and The Lady of Shalott and I Am Sick of Shadows. So, oh, I really enjoyed working in this on this assignment because it allowed me the opportunity to acquire a deeper view of the prelaphyllite universe, the way how women are represented in these paintings, and also how they differed from the Victorian idea of the angel in the house. Because as we know, in the angel in the house idea, we had that women had to be chaste, pure, and closet in the private sphere, in opposition to the fallen woman, that is the woman, the prostitute, the let's say the femme fatale. So it was a term in the medium that could be placed these women in the prelaphyllite paintings.
And so what made you settle on Ophelia as a big focus for your research? Did that come from the Pre-Raphaelites, or did you go from Ophelia and then was interested in depictions of Ophelia? What made you settle on her?
Well, not really, because to answer that question, I had to go back when I was admitted in the doctoral program to answer that question. I had always been fascinated by Shakespeare, his plays, his characters, his stories, but more precisely, his female characters, Ophelia, Juliet, Miranda, all of them. So I intended to do my PhD dissertation on something related to Shakespeare, but I know I wasn't really sure what would be the topic. And the topic was proposed by my PhD supervisor, who suggested me or who proposed me a topic that was Shakespearean heroines. But in order to trace that delimitation, we have two categories because we have tragic and innocent heroines, and they are adult heroines. In the adult heroines, we have Lady Macbeth, Desdemona, we have even some of the plays, the tragedies, but in the other side of the coin, we have the tragic heroines. The tragic innocent heroines that we have, Juliet, Ophelia, even we have Cordelia. So this idea was the let's say the start of my PhD, because I have to choose between Ophelia, Cordelia, and I decided Ophelia because what really attracted me was the way Ophelia was repudiated and overshadowed by other characters, let's say Hamlet, Queen Gertrude. So I wanted to go farther in her representation in the play. And also how it is possible that this character that has a lot of representation in the prelaphyllite paintings has a scarce background in the play because she's constantly surrounded by other characters, as she doesn't have free will to do anything.
Yes.
So we have some ways that Ophelia can be portrayed or represented.
So can we just have a little think about Ophelia? Because I'm sure many of our listeners will certainly know the story of Ophelia, the story of Hamlet. But I'm sure plenty would appreciate a quick refresh on Ophelia's role in Hamlet. So could you just briefly outline who she is in the story and sort of what a bit of a bio of Ophelia, if you like.
Well, as it follows in the play, Ophelia is introduced as Polonius' daughter the first time she's in the play, and she is Hamlet's love interest and Laertes' sister. We can see that the genitive Saxon indicates that she's subjected to a male character, let's say a father, a brother, a boyfriend, or the male society in general. So her role in the play revolves around her relationship with these three characters. In fact, Shakespeare doesn't provide a detailed background for Ophelia, because we don't know if she's an orphan, if she has a mother, if she went to school when she was a girl, and she only appears in five scenes of the play, and much of the information that we have about her comes from other characters such as Hamlet, her father, and Queen Gertrude. And this connection with men limits her agency and leads her to her death. Let's say that these men control Ophelia's action from the very beginning. In the first scene that she appears, Laertes and Polonius warn Ophelia not to believe Hamlet's words. They say that Hamlet is unworthy of her affections. He doesn't deserve her love. So Ophelia, what they want to project is that she deserves a better man, or in another case, she deserves to be a different woman, or even restricted to the private sphere. However, the situation worsens when Hamlet loses his senses, because at some point he feigns madness or becomes mad, depending on the opinion. And at the end of Act Three, Polonius pushes Ophelia to return Hamlet's love letters and to abandon his feelings. Ophelia obeys as a good daughter, but her actions provoke Hamlet's anger, leading him to say the word, the statement, "Go to a nunnery," as a way to protect her or to send her. We are not sure what he implies at that point. In Act 4, Hamlet kills Polonius, and Ophelia, as a result, descends into madness and dies under mysterious circumstances. She drowns, but we are not sure what was the reason of her drowning. And it could be said that Ophelia's tragedy is that he loses her innocence for no reason. It could be love of sexual, it could be unrequited love. We are not sure. So we have some gaps in the play that it could be the reason why the protagonist likes love her, or they cause them they put their focus on Ophelia.
Yeah, I was thinking So one of the questions I'd thought of beforehand was what was it about Ophelia that so appealed to the Pre-Raphaelites? But I think maybe it is something in this idea of having agency and the fact that she's a character that's completely, like you say, controlled, and her narrative, her story is just told through the words of other men. And then there's the other layer onto that, which would be Shakespeare is telling the story, and perhaps there's something in there. But then I was also wondering around the get thee to a nunnery line. I wonder if that's works as some sort of equivalent to the institution of the 19th century and that idea of restricting women's agency. I'm just thinking perhaps it'd be an interesting way of commenting on the 19th century through Shakespeare. But I'm this is just me thinking out loud. I'm sure you've got many thoughts on that. What do
You
you
are
think?
right. You are right, because at that time, women were locked in asylums, institutions. Those women whose only fault, in a way to say, is that they speak their minds. I mean, those women who rebelled against conventions of the Victorian society, they were called mad, even sorry for the word horse, or even whatever. So a woman who spoke their mind was a danger for society, because we have there is a word at that time and the previous century that was erotomania. That was a woman who was obsessed with a man, but in a sexual way, that he was very openly sexual. She expressed her feelings, her desires, and that was not expected for a woman at that time. We can trace a connection between this idea of the mat of law, mat, rebel woman, because it happened the same during the 17th century, Shakespeare's times, because women didn't have free will to express their feelings, to have a life of their own. They depend on men for everything, let's say their fathers, their brothers, and ultimately their husbands. So this we can extrapolate Ophelia's history to the Victorian period, because at that time, if we remember, we have the separate sphere ideology, in which women were expected to be at home, whereas the men were expected to be in the public, let's say working, being politics, being clerks, or whereas the women, their only role was to be at home, to take care of the children, to be devoted to the house, to take care of their parents or whatever. We can say that an image that come at attention to is that in some of these paintings, in the pre-Raphaelite paintings, Ophelia is wearing a white dress.
Yes.
That is a representation of purity, innocence, and with some blue dresses as an allegory of the Virgin Mary. So we can find a connection between the white dress of Ophelia in these paintings and other Victorian paintings, such as the painting of Queen Victoria's first council, the morning of her coronation. So this idea of innocence was what the Pre-Raphaelites was admired or liked. This idea of purity, innocence.
Oh, okay. And what can you outline some of the key works that Ophelia's been depicted in? I know we, I'm sure we know some of the big ones, but I know she's quite prevalent across the Pre-Raphaelites.
I think that the most important could be Millet painting, Waterhouse series, Rossetti's.
Yes.
But I think that the most important or the prototype of Ophelia was Millet's painting because it was taken from Shakespeare's text. Where Millet offered is the description of Queen Gertrude, the way she was told that Ophelia died. So Millet wanted to offer his own vision or his own vision, sorry, his own vision of the death of Ophelia. But I would like to add that all these Ophelias could be seen as a object of observation, or as an object for observation, I mean. They focus on their jaws, on her jaw, her beauty, her purity. And this begs to the question of whether such focus highlights the sadness of her wasted life. The bright flowers are a reminiscence of her madness. It could be said that the pre-Raphaelite influence on the 19th century English art establishes a connection between Ophelia's physical appearance and her mind as a way to juxtapose her youth, her beauty, with her death, as a way to create a beautiful, lively description of death. I mean, I know I'm not saying that it is morbid, but as a way to create as a way that her death was not the end, only the beginning of a new life, or to a greater extent, another image of Ophelia that we don't know at that point.
Yeah, that interconnection between beauty and death and madness as well, to some extent. It's a really strange point, and it's, I think it's something the Pre-Raphaelites deal with quite a lot, that point where death becomes beautiful and beauty becomes deathly, and it's almost two oppositional things that sort of meet somewhere. And I think Ophelia particularly highlights this well.
I would say that what these paintings intend to offer by representing her death in that way is to give Ophelia some agency and not to see her as a vessel, as a womb that has to carry a legacy or even to carry the future of the Danish throne, because we can imply or we can presume that at some point of the play, Ophelia and Hamlet have an intimate relationship. We can assume or we can read between the lines that they had an affair at some point. So what these paintings focus or represent is an intricate and lively composition, drawing inspiration from nature and medieval art of the cowrie love, the adoration of a maiden, of a lady. And what these artists portray is Ophelia in a state of madness or insanity, but at the same time mirroring the tragical or the tragic development of her character in Shakespeare's play, because her death was a bit unfair. So we can say that these paintings offer a novel perspective of Ophelia infusing their own sensibilities into the depiction of her. They employ symbolism, they employ composition and color to communicate those feelings and the things that go beyond the entire story.
Yes.
Because according to Elaine Showalter, she claims that there is no story of Ophelia that is not properly the story of her representation, that represents the era, the culture, the construction of women's roles, the madness and the essentialized notions of femininity. So we can find that this and that the main characteristic of the features of Ophelia's character represent the societal expectations of women in general, as a representation of women in general, their frustrations, their limitations. And I think that I have been a bit go beyond the idea of your question, but I think that that was the main idea of these paintings.
I think it's really difficult to discuss Millet's Ophelia without picking up on the sort of almost uncanny mirroring of Elizabeth Siddal and that idea of I'm paraphrasing a lot here, but that idea of the beautiful and the deathly, and ultimately the act of sort of suicide and madness. Is that an area you've looked at?
I'm not very into this, but I could say that Millet's painting is a mirror of the life of Lizzie Seidel, because after the composition of the painting, I think that she caught a flu or she died prematurely. So we can find some connection between her and Ophelia as a way to claim her voice and her agency, because she was amused of the Pre-Raphaelites, but she wasn't given too much attention by them. He was their muse, but not in the physical sense or even in the way that she expected. So what she does is, or what she did is, as a way to extrapolate or to project their frustration in this scene.
Yeah, it's an interesting parallel, because Elizabeth Siddal, she's another sort of person from the Pre-Raphaelite history, really, that's had their story almost entirely depicted by men, and doesn't appear to have had a lot of agency on sort of her own life and how that was presented and projected. So it's just an interesting mirroring with Ophelia. And, you know, there's a lot of scholarship now with Siddal that's sort of moving her beyond this idea of the melancholic muse and actually trying to rewrite a little bit of agency into her story. So again, it's an interesting parallel with the work you're doing with Ophelia.
Yeah, I know. We can also find that women in general at that time felt that way too, because they didn't have free choice to do anything, as I said before. So I think that they find some kind of projection or they see themselves in that mirror that was the beauty, the innocence, the purity in these paintings, because women at that time were also seen as vessels, only to carry the future of the family, but all kinds of women, from the upper classes, from the lower classes, and even the Queen Victoria herself, I mean, because she gave birth to 19 children. And I think that she even felt that way too. She was seen as a vessel to carry the future of England. So I think that all these women seen themselves represented in those paintings, and they wanted to be more at that time.
That's brilliant. So not just agency for Ophelia, agency for women all over the world. That's fantastic. Is Millet your favorite? Millet's depiction?
I have to say that I haven't thought about it, but it's one of my favorites because of that reason. But also the symbolism of the flowers, because all this painting in general has a lot of meaning. Even the water, we can say that the water in this painting, it could represent as the amniotic liquid, as a way to say that she's swimming towards a new life, and this liquid is like a baptism in which she starts again, she's reborn. So I could say that it could be one of my favorites. And also, Waterhouse series, the three pictures that he produced in different years, in which he is taking a stroll, she's walking along the river, she's picking flowers, because in Waterhouse paintings, there is no madness. Well, in all these paintings, there is no madness at all. So we can assume that maybe what the Pre-Raphaelites liked about her is not her madness, so her instead her lack of madness. And I like the way they represent her in that way too. So I think that these four paintings could be my Pre-Raphaelites paintings favorites. So
I thought it was interesting, really interesting what you're saying about the water being like it's like baptismal and like a cleansing and a new life. I've also come across the idea of water as a barrier or a portal between the living and the dead, and it's you can see that particularly in the Millet, you know, just about to die, you know, it's
a threshold, like between a new life and the old.
Yeah, that's it. I really like that idea. And I just thought of a question. The flower symbolism in the Millet painting, you mentioned about it. Was that drawn from the Shakespearean text? The flowers?
And there is, I think it was, they are also, they are taken from other passages in which she delivers flowers. There is rosemary for you, pansies, poppies. So all these paintings appeared in the painting as a way to remember what she gave to other characters, because she gave a flower to Hamlet, her father, Gertrude. So these paintings are put like a throne or like a carpet to carry her, or as a way to glorify her, because I think it was one of them that represent the tragic life, or even the loss of innocence. I think it was the pensive,
Yes,
if I'm right.
I think so.
But also, I think it was also in that painting, Lavender, too. I think it was Lavender. And this idea of the flowers could also be related to the language of the flowers in the Victorian period,
Yes.
that all of them had a meaning, the orchids, the pansies, the gardenias. So I think all of them create a myriad of 19 and Victorian ideas or messages that are put little by little in the painting. And they create a beautiful composition as a whole in everything.
Fantastic. I'm sure there's a scene where she's gathering flowers and she's singing to herself. I think if I recall it, and the song "How Should I, My True Love, Know?" It's just an interesting little aside. Our introduction on the podcast is the musical score for the first line of that. So if anybody's interested. I suppose a big question then, sort of, what's the legacy of Ophelia in the 21st century? What's her place now for women, for scholars, for artists, for literary students?
I think that it's a tough question to answer, because we have that Ophelia in general not only embodies the norms of the middle class femininity, but also the characteristics of a female transgressor, in the sense that, according to Ellen Showalter, there is no singular, definitive representation of Ophelia that the feminists can advocate for. I mean, Ophelia embodies a variety of perspectives and complexities that surpasses her individual components, akin to a cubist figure. I mean, we have that in the source text. We have, let's say, a pre-Ophelia or a proto-Ophelia. But if we go further, we get that her representation has been reinterpreted to the point of changing the artistic movement and suggesting a representation of the victims of the patriarchal dominance. And in contrast, in the British, the English contemporary English fiction, we have a different portrayal of Ophelia. Because in all of the in the novels, or the painted the novels that I analyzed on my thesis, she's portrayed as a empowered character. She speaks her own mind. So we can find that her drowning some point of Hamlet will be seen as a reverse, as I was telling you before. And a new life is given to her. She has a unique personality. And she's not a pure example, but a model of many other values. She's let's say, a feisty heroine, an active character, because in some of the novels that I analyze, for instance, Lisa Klein's Ophelia, She educates herself. She
Mm.
gets some education. She even expresses her visions of love in one of the most wonderful descriptions of love. And she even wants to be, or she wants to get out of the of Elsinore. She wants to travel around the world. She wants to know about different cultures. But what she really wants is to love and be loved. So this idea of love for Ophelia in this novel, we can see that she's not mad. She expresses her feelings, her inner feelings. And we can find that she truly, truly loves Hamlet, and Hamlet loves her too. So this idea of love will be seen not as an obsession, but as a way to, as a way of adoration, or let's say, glorification of, well, not glorification, but a different vision of her love towards Hamlet.
Well, Rathio, it's been amazing having you on the podcast. It's been a wonderful, wonderful discussion there on Ophelia. It's just been really interesting to explore some of these big themes and some of your research. Just thank you so much for coming. And is there anything in particular you'd like to promote? Have you got any websites or any work or anything you'd like to direct our listeners to?
Well, I mostly use my social media to promote my research in an accessible and engaging manner. So everyone who is unfamiliar with my topic can gain a greater understanding of my work. And they can email me too if they want to, or follow me in my social media if they want to making acquaintance with my job or with my research. So I would like to thank you and giving me the opportunity to taking part of this podcast today.
No problem. It's been a pleasure, and you're always welcome back. So honestly, thank you very much. That was really, really enjoyable. Thank you all very much to all of our listeners. We hope to hear you again soon. Hear from you again soon. If you are interested, you can please check out our website at www.preraphaelitesociety.org and consider subscribing to our journal. Thank you very much. Bye.